Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to The Drill Down, the business stories behind stocks on the move. I'm Corey Johnson. Today is July 14, and this is episode number 52. Well, just ahead, Norwegian Cruise Line sues for the right to make sure all of its passengers are vaccinated. Plus, American Airlines is certain that business travel is coming back, and the CEO tells us why. And Purple Innovation CEO Joe Megibow tells us why bloated inventories helped them crush sales during the pandemic. But first, it's sponsor time.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Era, a one-stop equity platform where you can seamlessly connect to any earnings call and surface actionable insights automatically. Era's AI-powered tools will allow you to work faster and smarter. That's Era, AIERA.com.
And if you're fully vaccinated, grab someone by the lapels and say, listen to the Drill Down podcast. Tell them to go to their favorite podcast platform and check out our show and tell them why you enjoy it so much.
And let us know what companies you think we should be drilling down on. Talk to us on Twitter and Instagram by following at Drill Down Pod and connect with us directly at our website, bizpod.net.
I'm Corey Johnson. Welcome to the Drill Down. We're going to talk about the business stories behind some stocks on the move and get some news from our executive producer, Isaac Webster. Isaac, tell me the three most important developments in the world of business today.
Well, Corey, we got to start with the Fed. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell said inflation had increased notably and would likely remain elevated in the coming months before it moderates. The Fed chief was testifying to the House Financial Services Committee on Capitol Hill. Powell said pandemic-related bottlenecks and other supply constraints created, quote, just the perfect storm of high demand and low supply that led to rapid price increases for certain goods and services. He expects these increases should partially reverse as the effects of the bottlenecks unwind. Powell went on to say the Fed shouldn't raise interest rates due to a one-time price increase.
We'll see how one-time they are and how much the genie's in the bottle. I mean, so many of the people we talk to say that inflation in one place causes them to raise prices in another place, which ends up being a real cycle. I know it's off of low numbers from last year. I know that used cars, as we've mentioned earlier, was a third of the most recent CPI change, but still, inflation begets inflation.
And then next story, OPEC. OPEC members reached a compromise with the UAE, United Arab Emirates. Reports say they have agreed to lift the amount of oil the UAE can eventually pump. Now, this is said to be part of a wider agreement with Russia-led producers to boost global supplies. The compromise still needs approval from the cartel and a wider group called OPEC Plus that includes Russia-led producers. A meeting to vote on this is yet to be scheduled. And what this means, though, is that any new output from a broader production increase deal reached earlier this month won't hit markets immediately.
Yeah, and we'll see about this deal. I mean, some members of UAE were already denying this deal, that this was a thing. Others saying this is a thing. I'll believe it when the vote happens.
Next, let's talk about climate. The European Union and China announcing sweeping plans to limit greenhouse gas emissions. The EU's plan would sharply cut the bloc's reliance on fossil fuels and place a first-of-its-kind levies on imports from high-emitting countries. Both plans, EU and China, will increase costs for industry and consumers, and they drew criticism from environmentalists as not going far enough to slow climate change. Beijing and Brussels are acting months ahead of the world's next climate change conference, and that's in November in Glasgow. Now, Corey, what stocks are you drilling down on today?
Well, I'll tell you the first one. You ready?
I'm ready.
Just checking. Norwegian Cruise Line.
Norwegian Cruise Lines trades under NCLH. Shares fell 3.5% today. But over the past 12 months, shares have risen 64%. What is going on with Norwegian?
Well, they want to sail their boats, obviously. And to do so, they have sued Florida's Surgeon General after the state barred businesses from requiring proof of COVID-19 vaccinations. Now, Norwegian is sticking to its policy to require everyone get vaccinated for all crew and passengers, including children, for initial sailings starting October 31st. after more than a year-long hiatus, and of course, billions of dollars that they have foregone during that time. Now, the policy in Florida, if they actually go ahead and do require these vaccines, Florida could fine them as much as $5,000 for each passenger affected. Now, the company says that Florida's ban also disrupts the flow of interstate and international commerce in violation of a clause in the U.S. Constitution that gives Congress the ability to regulate this stuff, not the guys in Florida. But Florida has tried to go its own way during this entire pandemic.
Florida's going to be Florida.
Yes, it is Florida man. In this case, Florida man being the Florida Surgeon General. And this suit is really interesting. CEO Frank Del Rio of Norwegian, very outspoken about the rules coming out of Florida and the CDC. He's had a lot of criticism for the CDC, even though he meets with them twice a week. Here's what he had to say back in May.
We're perplexed. We're flabbergasted. We're outraged. Airplanes, casinos, just about every venue. And when we talk about that we're willing to vaccinate every single person aboard the cruise ship, there isn't another venue on earth, not a school, not a factory, not your office building, apartment building, much less an entertainment venue like a casino, a hotel, a resort, that can make that claim. We will be the safest place on earth by definition. On top of that vaccination mandate, we're going to implement the 74 healthy sail panel recommendations. That 1-2 punch is unbeatable. No one on earth has it. Yet the CDC continues to treat us differently, we dare say unfairly. And look, it's not like the CDC has done a great job of controlling the virus around the country. We rank number one in the world for the most infections, the most hospitalization, I think the most death. Yet they pick on the cruise industry to an extreme that is just unbelievable, unexplainable, and frustrates us to no end.
So love that CEO speaking his mind, but also acting, in this case, acting against Florida and its requirements to proof of vaccination. But just because everyone's vaccinated, Isaac, doesn't mean you don't get COVID.
Doesn't mean you're not going to get COVID, myself included. What Corey's alluding to is that I am fully vaccinated. I have been since February. And yet I caught COVID last week in Provincetown.
You got COVID.
A number of my friends, a lot more people that I just know of, but all of them fully vaccinated. And in Provincetown, Massachusetts, that's on Cape Cod for people that aren't aware, but it's a summer vacation spot. It's normally 3,000 people live in Provincetown over the summer. It's generally 60,000 people are visiting at any given week. And, but in Provincetown last week, they were requiring proof of vaccination to many bars that people were frequenting. The ones I went to, you had to show your vaccination card for the most part. There were a few places that weren't doing that. Yet you can read about it online. There's an outbreak of breakthrough infections in fully vaxxed people like myself catching COVID.
Now, how are you feeling?
For me, it's like a bad cold. Yeah. So the thing is with the vax, you need to get vaccinated anyway, because when you're vaccinated, if you do catch COVID, it's milder. I have a very, very minimal chance of hospitalization and death and all those things. And also I'm less infectious because I'm vaccinated.
And so your family and your kids, everybody's
yeah, yeah. Clear. Thankfully, I mean, knocking on so much wood, but thankfully my family has not gotten COVID. So, and I have two young kids who are too young to be vaccinated yet. And they've been tested multiple times and they are all still negative. So that's good.
And I'm on the tail end of it. I don't know if it's the Delta version or not.
No, you know what? I don't know if it's a Delta version yet. I'm sure that they do somewhere in the science labs that they've run all the tests in. But I've actually called to find out if it was. I have not gotten a call back yet.
And if you get the Delta version, do you get SkyMiles with that or no?
I think so.
I think you should get
it. I get a free upgrade.
I won't be praying for you because it seems like you're feeling okay.
I'll just be praying for your
SkyMiles. There we have
but
it.
But here's the thing. Who wants a cold? No one. Just get vaccinated, people. Please. Please do it. What's your next drill down, Corey?
Well, let's go down, not to Delta, but to American Airlines.
American Airlines trades under AAL. Shares rose over 2.5% today, and for the last 12 months, shares have risen 77%. What's the story with American?
Okay, so American Airlines came out with an update on the revenue guidance, and they basically said things are going better than they even predicted in their most recent quarterly results, and they told the rest of the world to get ready for a little bit better quarter. They're not ready to announce it yet, but they said compared to 2019, they weren't going to be down 40%. They'll only be down 37.5%. All right, whatever, minor tweak, but things are a little bit better than they expected. They expected capacity to be a little bit better, again, down about 25% from 2019. Earlier, they were saying they'd be down 20 to 25%. And the company is saying the cost per seat mile will be up. We've been talking lots and lots about inflation. Not as much as they had said earlier. Earlier, they'd said between 13 and 17, just call it 15%. Now they're saying it's going to be closer to 11 or 11.5%. So things a little bit better. But I thought it was really interesting, the big difference, right? So leisure travel, as you engaged in last week, Isaac, through the roof. People are going on vacations. People are going to see grandparents and parents that they haven't been able to see for a long time for the entirety of COVID. And so vacation travel is booming. Business travel is not coming back. But will it? Well, here is the philosophy of Bill Parker, the CEO of American Airlines, talking at an investor conference a couple weeks ago.
As we take a look out in the future, it really is tied to vaccination rates, offices opening, and then business can get back to it. And over the long run, our view hasn't changed. Our view has been really rooted in every advancement in technology, communications technology, ultimately leads and drives a need for people to get together. And I don't think what we're going through right now is any different. While there may be some internal meetings that can be conducted like we're doing today, it just drives the need for more and different types of getting together and travel. Whether that is people working remotely that now have to get back to a headquarters office, or new connections that have been made through these types of Zoom meetings that inspire travel. So my confidence is that business travel is something that is going to return. Over the long run will be a significant portion of our business.
So, obviously you expect an airline guy to be the true believer about airline necessity. But I do think it was interesting, this idea that the remote worker who now is going to stay remote will add a new type of travel, which is your kind of the check-in with the home office that didn't used to exist. And maybe that might make up for some of the lost travel from unnecessary team meetings.
Maybe, but that does not mean that those companies are going to be paying business class fares to bring people back into the home office to say hello.
Good point. Do we get to fly to business class for the Business Podcast Network?
Of course we do. We're first class. I mean, that's what I've been charging you.
Wait a minute.
Corey, what's your next drill down?
Let's look at Linux.
Linux International trades under the ticker LII. Shares fell 7% today, but over the past 12 months, they are higher by 30%. What's the story with Linux?
So let's think about that, right? 30%, the market's up about 40% over that time. So Linux not doing great, but actually the company looks like it's doing well. Today it announced that their CEO, his name is Todd Bluedorn, that after 15 years running this company, he's going to step down next year. He wants to spend more time with his family, all that stuff. But he's gonna be there for another year yet, and they're looking for a new CEO. And they raised their guidance, saying that revenues were going to be up. Their prediction had been about 8%. Now they're saying it's going to be about 13% increase in revenues. But I was curious about why they hadn't benefited as much as other companies with the kind of stay at home trade, right? The pandemic renovation trade. And it turns out they've seen some great results. They're going to give us their full results for the quarter on July 26th, but I thought it was worth listening to what the CEO had to say a couple weeks ago. Yet again, at another investor conference, here is the outgoing Todd Bluedorn.
I think there's a variable that we haven't quite quantified yet, but I think it's directionally helping, which is, I think when people are spending more time in their homes, they're A, running their units longer, and B, fixing, you know, replacing their units and or fixing their units when they're break. And I think that bodes well for the future. I think we at Lennox, and I think most companies, are going to have some form of work from home, increased work from home than what we had pre-pandemic. So I think that's a longer term phenomenon that's good for the industry, that quite frankly will shorten the life cycle of the product, which will spin the replacement market even faster.
So more HVAC, whether you need your heat or your AC, you always need your V. But I thought it was super interesting, the idea that if you're home more, you're going to run the unit more, and you're going to wear the thing out and have to replace it. And Lennox will benefit from replacing broken down heating and cooling units in homes.
Someone's got to do it.
All right. All right. Well, up next, another company that's done very well during the pandemic and came into it some really interesting problems that were all resolved by the pandemic. That company, Purple Innovations, you know their mattresses. You're going to love this interview with the CEO, Joe Megabow.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Era. Era's event access and monitoring intelligence platform improves earnings season and the investor events in between through comprehensive calendar tracking, one-click event access, dynamic monitors, multicasting, and more. Powered by an advanced language processing engine, which consumes some 40,000 investor events annually across 10,000 global equities. Learn more at Era, AIERA.com. And remember to join the Drill Down on Twitter and Instagram at Drill Down Pod. And check out our website, bizpod.net. Let us know what stocks we should be drilling down on.
All right, welcome back to the Drill Down. We're joined right now by the CEO of Purple Innovations, the mattress maker you all know and love, Joe Megabow, joins us right now. Joe, good to see you across the our Zoom-like interface here and hear you on the podcast. You guys have entered into a business I know a little bit. I did a lot of work on Tempur-Pedic back in the day, being about maybe 15 years ago. What has changed in the mattress industry over the course of the last 10 or 15 years?
Oh, goodness. Well, certainly, it was a great business model, a great category. And part of that, as a business, not necessarily from the consumer point of view, but as a business, you had, you know, tight category control, you know, very few, almost really an oligopoly of major players that really had strong margins and a lot of channel strength.
The S's, right?
It was the S's originally.
But that's interesting.
Because Tempur, who I think was largely dismissed as a novelty. I mean, consider they launched, you know, right on the end of waterbeds coming and going in the 70s. And I think they were dismissed as the next fad, and in the end bought
marketed
one of the
S's. They were marketed like Tang, right? It's technology from NASA. You know, it seems silly.
Exactly. And, you know, and wine glasses on the edge of the mattress as you bounced and they didn't fall over. But you know, it's fascinating that they ended up buying one of the three S's, and the other two S's had to join forces and ultimately acquired by private equity. And so, I mean, you know, Tempur clearly very much disrupted the industry, and, you know, Sleep Number came along about the same time, a very different business model because of their deeply technical sale.
They owned stores. In 300 malls. Tempur never did that. I saw Tempur at the time, and I see you in a similar way, which is you've got much higher margins than your competitors and a very differentiated product. I saw more as the Apple of mattresses.
Thank you. That's generous. But I think the Tempur model is a good one to look at, because I think we've been at times dismissed kind of like Tempur was in the early days. As perhaps a marketing novelty, where in reality, we really do have a very technically different product, and we, like Tempur, are a manufacturer of that different product. What I think's changed is, I think there's been a bifurcation of the commodity value side of the mattress space with the advent of, you know, really Chinese imports and the internet, and the premium side, which is actually continuing to increase in price. What I find fascinating is, you know, roughly 3/4 of all the units sold out there are less than $1,000, you know, just inexpensive commodity mattress led by retailers like IKEA, Wayfair, Amazon, and Walmart, who have largely vertically integrated or in the process of vertically integrating with house brands. You know, but those 75% of units only capture like 40% of industry revenue.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
the majority of the industry revenue is on the quarter of units on the premium side. And even that is split between sort of 1 to 2,000 and then 2,000 and beyond. And, you know, the least expensive mattress we sell for a queen is $1,200. So, you know, we are very much on the premium side where there's been much less disruption. And, you know, where on the low end, the focus has been on convenience and, you know, really how you win on commodity. Lower your, you know, get, you know, capture as much of the margin you can by vertically integrate and be as easy and as convenient as possible. On the premium side, you win on technical differentiation. And the two biggest winners are Sleep Number and Tempur-Pedic, who both are built on a technical story. That's our whole game. We just believe we genuinely have an advancement that consumers are voting with their wallets and saying they agree we have something better.
Well, and that's my Apple comparison, right? Is that at the premium end, whether it's Tempur or whether it's you, you've got of substantially most of the industry revenues and real gross margins. I mean, I think your gross margins last year were 47%. And that's just astounding.
Yeah, we did very well last year. The big shift that happened last year, which it's dangerous to draw a trend line from last year, is with COVID and our digital capabilities, we were uniquely able to capture a traditionally brick and mortar customer and bring them online. Because the premium buyer is 85% brick and mortar. With stores shut down and an inability to buy in brick and mortar, we took a lot of share. And that our margins are so much better on DTC. It just distorted our margins up.
Well, you were still at 44% the year before.
That's right. But I want you to break that down. Yeah.
Yeah. And full disclosure, long before I started this podcast company, long before I was a shareholder of Purple, I played it completely wrong. When all the Costcos across the country shut down, I was like, I'm out of here. This stock's going nowhere. I mean, yeah, they can sell this stuff online, but it was totally wrong. You really dominated online. Talk to me about what you did, what you tweaked in the operations during that time frame. It was a chaotic time for all of us. What was it like for Purple, and where did you see suddenly you had this great advantage?
Yeah, and I think it'll be important at the end of this to also talk about what's changed today versus last year. There's really a very different chapter going on right now. But, you know, as a manufacturer, one of the, you know, part of the strength we have is when the pandemic first hit, and we were actually very concerned because, you know, we were selling in at the time just shy of a couple thousand wholesale doors. Memorial Day was coming up, and we were sitting on a bunch of inventory that was about to go out the door to all of our retail partners, and they stopped buying, obviously. So we had shelves full of inventory. We had no idea what was in front of us, and we actually shut the plant down for about 3 weeks, and I furloughed about a third of the company. Not a great time for anybody. What happened over those next 3 weeks was pretty remarkable. What we saw, the question was, were consumers going to defer and wait until everything got back to normal, or were they going to say, no, I need these products for my home? And over the next few weeks, with a combination of stimulus, a recognition that we're going to be home a while, a recognition that health and sleep are pretty important right now, suddenly demand grew a lot. And then the question is, who could meet that demand? What was remarkable is almost everyone panicked and pulled out of the market. Digital marketing spend disappeared.
Yeah.
The economics of marketing improved dramatically. And while everyone was pulling in, we doubled down and leaned in hard. We said, okay, we're going after this premium buyer. There is an addressable market we hadn't been reaching that we could find and go after, and cast a much, much wider net than normal. In digital marketing, there is no double your spend, double your business. I mean, there's just diminishing returns. Last year, we did that.
Really?
We doubled our spend and we doubled our business. So we were able to, and oh, by the way, with much better marketing efficiencies, we actually ended up with even better marketing efficiencies than the prior year. And it was just a combination of an unusual addressable market that showed up, our ability to really arbitrage, market dynamics, and our ability to reach that consumer, and competition that just wasn't set up for digital as a primary channel. And we did remarkably well.
So let's dig into that a little bit more. The marketing efficiencies that you got, how you did that marketing, what happened to the cost of the digital spend, and how you found out what worked. I have much to learn about the world of marketing, so teach me. And you came from Expedia. You obviously had this digital background. But what is it that worked for you in your digital advertising? How did you know it was working at the time? And presumably also got a lot cheaper during that time frame.
Yeah, until recently, we had mostly been a performance or direct response driven. Marketing spend was the majority of our spend, which is really, how do we capture people in market looking for mattress and reach the right demographic? Because again, we're not going to win the auction model if you're looking for a $300 mattress. You know, they'll find us, say, this is ridiculously expensive, you guys are crazy.
The auction model of buy an ad right the second someone does a Google search for a cheap mattress for sale.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of consumers out there that just want value. They have no interest. And again, remember, it's the majority of transactions are these inexpensive mattresses. So the question was, how do we find the right audiences with the right message and make the CAC, the acquisition cost, the customer acquisition cost, work? Now, part of the advantage we have with our unit economics is when our average selling price for a mattress is close to $2,000, and you already talked about our gross margins in the 40s, we have a lot of acquisition cost to play with and still run a very profitable business. And that's what we did. We knew what our maximum return on investment could be. Tweaked algorithmically how to really find these premium audiences, and then just leaned in really hard.
And so let me drill into that even a little deeper then. Is that about digital advertising? Is it about search? Is it about certain media to be on online? Is it email marketing, or is it all the above?
Yeah, well, it's it is a very data-driven, complex channel today. Now, the majority of our spend are dominated by the two biggest channels out there, which is Google's holdings, and we actually do an enormous amount on digital video. It's how we really launched the business. So we spend, relative to the market, a disproportionate amount on YouTube, things like pre-roll ads, and Facebook, which includes Instagram. And both of those channels are really good at segmentation and targeting. And it's just a matter of how sophisticated are you in finding those targets and leaning into them. And we've built a really amazing team. And it's not even just an audience put an ad. It's the full journey mapping. I mean, we have millions of consumer touch point flows that we model out and lean into that's all algorithmically driven to allow us to maximize how much are we going to pay for any given placement and which placements. I mean, even in a given campaign, we may have 30 or 40 iterations of an ad unit that we algorithmically put out and optimize to the winners. So it's very data driven. But at its core, it comes from messaging that works. What are the key messages about our product differentiation? What are the key messages about our product? And then the rest is just optimization into the right targets.
It is interesting because you guys do spend a ton on marketing. Pre-pandemic, it was 33% of sales. Last year, you had a lot of things working for you. It was only 29% of sales, even though it was a lot more money, but there were a lot more sales. Did you find that how consumers received digital marketing during the pandemic changed from what it was before? Were they more open to it? Were there different messages that worked?
The simple way I'd say it is, here's an interesting lens to look through. As a manufacturer that has had incredible growth, I mean, our compound annual growth rate over the last 5 years has been 78%. For a manufacturer, that's kind of nuts. I mean, it's just, growing a manufacturing capability that fast breaks companies, and it's broken us many times. And we've had to really mature operations to go from, a single machine making these things to now 1.5 million square feet of space that we're building into in 5 years. We've been capacity constrained our entire history, and we felt that last year. And what that means is through most of our life, we sell every unit we make, which very few retailers can say that. Sell every unit we make. Last year, we basically sold the exact same beds at the exact same product mix and price points we would have if the pandemic hadn't happened. we were just able to find that customer that would have bought offline, shifted online. So yeah, there was a remarkable sort of fungibility of consumers that hadn't been shopping online and hadn't been willing to buy online that out of necessity moved online. And I think we've transformed the industry as a result. I think there is a bigger buyer online indefinitely now. I mean, there's a pendulum swing back. It's not going to be as online as it was out of necessity, but in the end, we're going to be more online than we were when this started, and that's great for a brand like ours.
Yeah, it really is. The transformation of so many things have been accelerated. We keep hearing that story over and over again. What behaviors for your company do you think have changed forever that happened during the pandemic? Is there going to be more work from home? Is there going to be less corporate travel? Is there going to, I don't know.
Yeah, we're over 1,600 employees now, the vast majority of which are manufacturing and logistics, and as well as things like field
which they won't do from home.
Yeah, they can't do that from home. So we had to, part of what's changed for us is a ever-growing focus on what I just say, the safety and welfare of our employees. If we couldn't make product, our business wouldn't exist. So through the pandemic, we had to significantly retool our operations to make sure we were creating a healthy, safe work environment for our employees, and even just acquiring talent. There was, with all of the stimulus that was out there to offset things like unemployment, I mean, the federal subsidies of $600, the $600 subsidy that was out there, there were, if you're making, $12, $13, $14 an hour, it was at a point that through the summer last year, you could make more money not working than working. You could actually go into unemployment, take all the subsidies, and net have a really nice summer staying at home and safe without being in the workforce. So, you know, sort of that working class side of things was very challenging last year, and we're still not fully out of it. And frankly, with the child credit coming out right now, I think we're going to see some of that again, where there is, we have not fully deployed all of the available labor in the U.S. And as a manufacturer, that is a challenge and continues to be.
And yet those same checks being written are going right into your top line with people buying mattresses. That must have had a big effect on your business.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. On the demand side, this is terrific for us. On the supply side, our ability to manufacture, it's a challenge. And it ultimately plays out in eroding margins. I mean, we have had to significantly increase our labor rates over the last couple of years in order to get the talent we need. Now, fortunately, we've also been able to take price actions and raise pricing to offset. But the gross margins get challenged as these labor rates go up.
So let me ask you about right now. What's happening with labor costs right now? Are you still raising pay scales across the board? And number two, I want to ask you about your raw materials costs, because your principal raw material is probably plastic, and plastic's made from oil, and oil's at $75 a barrel right now. That's got to have a big effect.
Yeah, we are. Labor is absolutely going up. I mean, we. A small little retail you may have heard of called Amazon has a billboard not far from our office advertising rates in their distribution center near our plant at $2 more an hour than we were paying, that every one of our employees saw every day as they drive to work. So, we've had to raise our rates about $2 an hour to compete with market forces, even though all of our benefits.
That billboard.
Compete with that billboard. And there's another retailer that has a similar one. Our benefits all in are much better. But at the end of the day, that marquee price point matters a lot. And we have seen significant inflation in labor. And that is a big component in our cost of goods. On raw materials like mineral oil and the plastic elastomers we use in our elastic polymer, those we've had less pressure on. The cost of foam has gone up, and we have some foam in our product. Freight is one area that we've seen significant increase in costs. And again, you have to think of us more like a furniture company. We're not, FedEx and UPS can only help us on a portion of our product because they cap out at about 150 pounds, and we have some very heavy items. So we are living in the world of freight, and freight, both inbound and outbound, has had significant increase in costs.
What kind of percentage are you talking about there?
Oh, goodness. All in. I mean, it's way into double digit percentages.
Really?
I don't have the exact number in front of me, but it's significant.
That's interesting. And so how far out do you see that? Because that's the other thing. You know, we're listening to conference calls every day. And the projections, keep getting pushed out. We're starting to hear about next year. We're hearing about shipping problems lasting until next year. We're hearing about semiconductor shortages going into 2022.
Yeah. Semiconductor impacts us less. But like, you know, for example, we have adjustable power bases, you know, adjustable bases under the mattress that have electronic components. I mean, we've got designs we're working on that very common electronic components, you know, have 50-week lead times. I've never seen it. There's fascinating secondary markets on these components as they have long shelf life and people overbuy, and it's just a fascinating space. Those are legitimate challenges. Freight, I mean, with FedEx and UPS, I mean, the fact that Amazon is bigger than both of them combined now on their logistics tells you how much of a capacity gap there is right now. So, I mean, we couldn't put all of our business with either one of them because they don't have enough capacity to service us individually. And beyond that, as you get into, you know, heavier freight, it's very taxed right now. And it's not just inflationary, it's lack of capacity. And you don't solve that overnight. And demand continues to grow for these channels. It's not going to be a simple fix. And it will be, I anticipate, years before this is all fully resolved.
Well, it's got to be nice to be addressing this from a place of profitability finally.
For sure. And it gives us, I mean, our look, as a truly vertically integrated brand, our number one goal is to own our destiny. And it's both up and downstream. And it creates opportunities. I mean, near our current manufacturing facilities, we do our own local delivery. And it turns out it's much higher customer satisfaction and it's lower cost all in. We continue to look for ways to be disruptive in margin accretive and EBITDA accretive ways. And fortunately, generally, these are great for the customer as well.
I'm going to avoid making any jokes about you must be sleeping well. But Joe, thank you very much. Joe Megibow is the CEO of Purple Innovations, joining us here in the Drill Down. Well, up next, the Drill Down Bite. We're going to tell you that one number that means a whole lot. We told you about that massive marketing expense. How much did this company spend last year on marketing? It's going to knock your socks off. We'll tell you that number right after this.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Era, a one-stop equity platform where you can seamlessly connect to any earnings call and surface actionable insights automatically. Era's AI-powered tools will allow you to work faster and smarter. That's Era, AIERA.com.
And if you like The Drill Down as much as we do, how could you not? Go on your favorite podcast platform and leave a review. Let the rest of the world know why you like this show.
And let us know what companies you think we should be drilling down on. Talk to us on Twitter and Instagram by following @DrillDownPod. And connect with us directly at our website, bizpod.net.
All right, the Drill Down Bite, that one number that tells us a whole lot. Last year, Purple Innovation spent $187,991,000 on marketing. And yet that was only 29% of revenues, a lot less than it had been percentage-wise, Isaac, the year before. All right, that's all for the Drill Down today. Thanks for joining us. I'm Corey Johnson. Isaac Webster's our executive producer. The Drill Down's a production of the Business Podcast Network.